So one way we can think about attention is that it's like a flashlight. And just like a flashlight in a darkened room, wherever our attention is directed, more information becomes available. So it is the case that we can have a laser-like focus, just like a flashlight that may be have a very narrow focus or a broad focus. But what happens is that wherever that flashlight is directed, information is clearer, richer, more comes in. And you can direct it at will. We call this the brain's orienting system of attention. And in contrast to the orienting system is something we call the alerting system. The metaphor I use there is sort of a caution sign, or even you might think of a flashing yellow light while you're driving on the road. When you see a flashing yellow light or a caution sign, you might not know exactly what the danger or potential threat might be. But the intention is to keep your attention in a readied state so that no matter what might come your way, you're prepared to deploy your attention in the service of benefiting your performance. So we could think of the brain's alerting system as quite the opposite of the orienting system. Whereas orienting the flashlight means narrowing and selecting, the alerting system is about broadening and preparing. And both of these are going to be very important tools for our attention and for attention training as well. Related to attention, sort of a close cousin of attention, is something called working memory. And I use the metaphor of a whiteboard, the mind's internal whiteboard. And I want to push it a little further. It's a whiteboard that has disappearing ink. The ink on the whiteboard will disappear within a few to several seconds. So what is working memory? Working memory is the ability to maintain and manipulate information over very short periods of time, from a few seconds to a few minutes. So think about the last time you were at a restaurant and had to calculate a tip. Essentially, you wrote on the whiteboard to do the simple math, and then we're able to produce the tip amount. But you don't need to keep that information in long-term memory. You, in fact, don't want to keep it in long-term memory. Or think about the last time you might have been in a conversation with somebody and you were holding the idea that you wanted to express while you kindly let the person finish speaking. In that case, you also used your working memory, wrote on the mental whiteboard what it is that you want to say, and then, of course, once it was said, it was gone. The ink was gone. So working memory works very well with the brain system of attention. Once information is selected into this system, working memory allows us to maintain it. Of course, orienting, alerting, working memory, these are all functions that we all need in order to engage in fluid human behavior. And when these work well, we perform well. Unfortunately, these same three systems can make us quite vulnerable to psychological diseases as well. That might be surprising for some of you who may understand that our cognitive function and our emotional health may be completely separate. And what I have to tell you is that that's not the case. These core cognitive systems are extremely important for our psychological health. So let me tell you what I mean by that. Think of these three disorders: depression, hypervigilance, and attention deficit disorder. We can characterize each of these in some sense as a problem with the brain's attention or working memory systems. For depression, you might think of that flashlight of the orienting system being stuck on depressogenic content, so that negative thoughts and memories may be the only place that flashlight chooses to shine. And it's very hard to remove our attention away from that type of content, which leads to this cascade of clinical disorder. Or in the context of something like hypervigilance that might happen in a disease like post-traumatic stress disorder, we can see that people might start observing in their world everything as a caution sign or a flashing yellow light. There's this propensity to see the need to be on high alert always. And unfortunately, it might not serve us as we're just having a normal walk down a city street and there is no threat. But if our attention system is oriented this way, it can become quite problematic. And finally, the example of attention deficit disorder. In some ways, we can think of this as an overly cluttered working memory or a whiteboard that's got so much stuff on it, you can't make sense of what you need to do. In some types of attention deficit disorder, we can also think of it as a whiteboard whose ink disappears too quickly. The information is not able to be maintained long enough for us to actually execute our goals. So outside the context of attention systems going awry that lead to clinical disorders, many of us, even if we don't suffer from clinical disorders, may feel that our attention system can become compromised. And I'd like to return back to this metaphor of the MP3 player. Our brain, our mind, our attention system is exquisite at being able to engage in mental time travel. And as I mentioned, we can go to the past and the future with ease. But many times, this function of being able to rewind and fast forward can get our attention system into trouble. In some sense, we can think of rewinding to the past, not as simply as a way to reflect on what's happened, but under conditions of stress and distress in particular, we may end up ruminating, reliving, or regretting experiences that have already happened. So we're rewinding the mind and in some sense, attentionally rubbernecking to the past. It's like we can't help ourselves but go back in time. Or we fast forward in a way that's also not productive. We may end up catastrophizing or worrying over and over again about events that not only haven't happened yet, but frankly may never happen. And I bring these up because what it tells us is that attention can be hijacked in time. And there's something that we can really think about with regard to this hijacking, which is that there are fewer moments for the mind to keep the button right on play to experience what's happening in the here and the now, as what we describe as a mindfulness mode of being. Another way to think about this hijacking of attention from the present moment is something called mind wandering. Mind wandering has to do with having off-task thoughts during an ongoing task or activity. So think about the last time you were trying to read a book. We might glaze over, our eyes may be moving down the page. We get to the bottom of the page to realize we have no idea what we have just read. This would be a very salient and unfortunately for many of us a common experience of mind wandering. What happened there? What happened is that attention was not actually aligned with perception. Attention may have gone off in many other directions. So this mind wandering is very important for us to understand because it's not about just letting the mind flow wherever it will. It's not mind wandering in some sense or daydreaming or in psychology speak what we might call conscious internal reflection, right? Having spontaneous thought that'll go anywhere. Mind wandering has to do with actually wanting to accomplish a goal and having your mind hijacked away, your attention hijacked away from being able to accomplish that goal. So let's now, with these concepts in mind, the basic systems of attention, working memory, the vulnerabilities of attention with regard to mind wandering, let's return back to our question with regard to mindfulness training. If mindfulness training is training the brain, what is it training? As I mentioned, we need to think about the under-the-hood kind of components of the training exercises themselves. And as we already reviewed, the mindfulness of breathing exercise is a foundational training exercise. So let's return to that exercise. And now we're going to think about these components of the mindfulness of breathing exercise as it relates to these aspects of attention and working memory we just reviewed. So recall back that in the mindfulness of breathing exercise, the intention is to select a particular sensation. So in that sense, we can think of using our orienting system to direct the sensation once we've selected it to where our attention should be. Next, the instruction is to maintain our attention on that sensation or having it up on the mind's whiteboard, what it is that we're going to be focusing on, the coolness of air or the abdomen moving down, whatever it is, that's what's going to be maintained on the whiteboard. The next part of the instruction is to remain in this noticing or alert mode so that you can watch out for mind wandering. And then the final aspect of the instruction is to, once you've noticed that your mind has wandered, simply return it back. Or you could say, take that flashlight of attention and return it back to those breath-related sensations. So now that we can see this mindfulness of breathing exercise as in some sense a brain training exercise of attention, we want to start being able to build our hypotheses about what regions of the brain, what brain networks may be strengthened or impacted by engaging in such an exercise. And to get into this topic, we need to learn a little bit more, or I need to provide to you a little bit more about what is already known with regard to the brain science of attention. And there's three things I'd like to share with you that have to do with these aspects of attention we've already reviewed, this ability to select and maintain, our capacity to notice, as well as mind wandering. The broader cognitive neuroscience of attention literature has found that there are distinct networks that are tied to these three aspects of our functioning. Something called the central executive network, which involves the frontal lobes and parts of the parietal lobe, are involved in these capacities to select and maintain, or in our shorthand, the flashlight and the whiteboard. There are also networks distinct from this central executive network that are responsible for different aspects of functioning. So, for example, the alerting system, this noticing capacity of our brain, is subserved by a network called the salience network, where prominent structures of a region called the insula. And the third network that we're going to describe, that I'd like to describe to you, is something called the default mode network. This is the network that people typically associate with mind wandering. Now, why am I bringing up all three of these networks to you? Mainly is to say that these networks are established in the broader brain imaging literature, and of course there are many other networks. As I speak, I'm sure that these networks are being updated and modified in the literature. But the broad categories will probably still hold. And there's two important things I'd like you to understand about brain networks. In particular, these three attention-related networks. One of them is that they're anatomically distinct from each other. So the central executive network, the salience network, the default mode network, really rely on different brain regions within each of the networks. The second thing I'd like you to understand about these networks is they are mutually inhibitory. What do I mean by that? Well, when one network's activity is prominent, the other two networks actually have lower amounts of activity. So let's say that you are engaged in a highly selective task. Your laser-like focus is being used for something you're trying to do. In that sense, your central executive network is going to be more active, but your noticing network and your mind-wandering networks are going to be less active. And the opposite's also true. If you're engaged in a lot of mind-wandering, your capacity to select and direct your attention may become compromised. So the reason that these three networks are quite important from my point of view is that they give us a clue into the brain regions that may be involved in brain training involving mindfulness. So let's talk about the research that's been conducted on this topic of brain training and investigation of brain networks in people that are mindfulness practitioners or are participating in brain training involving mindfulness training. So there are two research designs that we've described, the cross-sectional design and the longitudinal design. The cross-sectional design involves long-term mindfulness practitioners, for example, versus other groups that don't have that as part of their life experience. The longitudinal design would be more of a training design that involves the randomized controlled trial. So in the context of mindfulness, this could be a design in which people are randomly assigned to participate in an 8-week mindfulness-based stress reduction course, for example, versus some other form of training. Or they may be involved and randomly assigned to participate in a multi-day mindfulness retreat. And the intention for those studies is to see if there are differences before and after engaging in the mindfulness training program. So what I'd like to tell you about next is what is known about these various research designs and the brain changes that may accompany mindfulness training. The first thing to say is that there are many different ways we can look at brain changes. But when we want to first look at structural changes in the brain, we might look at one of a couple of things. The first is something called brain gyrification. And that's kind of a mouthful of a term, but all it's referring to is sort of how tightly packed and condensed the brain is. So to put it more simply, we could think of the brain as a series of tissues, kind of like stacked pieces of paper. Gyrification has to do with crumpling up those pieces of paper as tightly as possible so that we can house the brain inside our skull. As we age, as we experience stress, as we might encounter brain-related disorders, the brain becomes uncrumpled. It becomes smoother. So a smoother brain, a less gyrified brain, is a less healthy brain. But a more gyrified brain, a more densely packed brain, is a healthier brain. So one of the questions researchers were looking at is to see if those individuals that engage in long-term mindfulness practice may have better gyrification, a more efficient-looking brain. And that's, in fact, what's been found. It looks to be the case that long-term mindfulness practitioners have cortical gyrification in networks that are tied to the brain's attention systems, which is very interesting because what it suggests is not only do certain parts of mindfulness practitioners' brains look healthier, but those same regions are those that are tied to what we hypothesized mindfulness exercises are actually training: attention, noticing, control over mind wandering. So now let's turn our attention to functional brain changes that may also be present in long-term mindfulness practitioners. One research study was interested in seeing if a particular brain network, known as the default mode, might actually have less activity in those individuals who are long-term mindfulness practitioners. Now, why would they have this prediction that the default mode may be less active? Recall back to what we were talking about a few moments ago, that the default mode is a brain network tied to mind wandering. And if the central practice of a mindfulness of breathing exercise, for example, is intending to have better control over mind wandering, such that it happens less frequently, you might predict that individuals that have been doing this for years on end may be better able to control the activity of this network. And in fact, that's what was found. It was found that two important nodes of the default mode, the medial prefrontal cortex as well as the posterior cingulate cortex, had less activity in mindfulness practitioners relative to control age and education matched control participants. This was very exciting because what it suggests is that not only do we see structural changes, but that the functional brain activity profiles also look in line with better performance and better brain health. Now let's move to thinking about not just these cross-sectional designs, which, as I mentioned previously, have their limitations. For example, we don't know, though it seems very promising, we don't know if long-term practitioners might have had brains that just happened to be more gyrified even before they decided to start practicing mindfulness. In fact, it may be that there's a causal relationship the other way. People that have gyrified brains may end up choosing to meditate or practice mindfulness. And it has nothing to do with the mindfulness actually instantiating those changes. It's an important possibility to consider. So a stronger test of this notion that brains can become healthier looking and function more efficiently as a function of mindfulness training requires us to really test this out with a randomized control trial. And that's what many different studies have been looking at now. Individuals are recruited into a mindfulness training study, and then they're randomly assigned to receive mindfulness training over, let's say, 8 weeks or some other condition. And what we do is look to see at the structure and function of the brain before and after participation in that multi-week training program. So far, we take our hypotheses from what's been found in long-term practitioners. Maybe the brains will be looking healthier. Their brains will be more gyrified. They'll be more densely packed with gray matter, for example. Maybe certain networks would be more efficiently functioning. And in fact, that is what it looks like is happening in what are now an aggregate set of studies, something called a meta-analysis, that allows us to put together not one or two studies, but dozens of studies to see what the pattern of research looks like. Meta-analyses now reveal that the kinds of structural and functional changes that are seen in randomized trials of mindfulness training look very much in line with what's seen in long-term practitioners. There are beneficial changes to the brain structure as well as to the brain's functioning. It's very exciting. Of course, we have to remember that though many research studies have been done, we are nowhere near the number that we now have for research investigating physical activity and physical health. Right? That number was 300,000. We're probably at a tenth of that. So it's exciting times, but much more research is needed. One final area that I'd like to share with you is work that's very close to the work that I hold near and dear in my own laboratory, looking at performance changes. Because, of course, all of us want to have healthy brains, but really we want that brain health to translate into the way we perform and act in the world. So we're going to now talk about some of the recent research studies we've done on cognitive effects of mindfulness training conducted in my own lab. Recall that I mentioned we look at many different groups, all of whom experience some type of demanding interval. And for these individuals, in many cases, their attention can be the difference between success and failure, for example, for a student, or unfortunately, life and death when you think about a firefighter or a military service member. Attention really matters. So the question now is, if it is the case, as the brain data suggests, the networks of the brain supporting attention are stronger and healthier, is it the case that performance on tasks of attention looks like it's better in those engaging in mindfulness training? And for the groups that I've looked at, unfortunately, attention is not staying stable over these high-stress intervals. what we find is that actually if you index attention using simple computer-based behavioral tasks, if you look at how well people perform, you see that over multiple weeks of high demand and high stress, attentional performance declines. And this is true for even elementary, middle, and high school students. Over the course of the semester, we see that attention gets compromised. And this is quite unfortunate because at the end of the semester, they have to take final exams. And that's where the performance will really matter. Unfortunately, they may have the most compromised attention at that point. Or think about the pre-deployment soldier who is preparing him or herself to be ready for deployment. But that training interval is leading up to deployment itself may degrade attention, so they're not in peak shape as they leave. Our interest for these types of groups is to promote something called cognitive resilience, this ability to maintain or regain cognitive capacities, in particular capacities like attention and working memory, that are at risk for declining. We want to keep those protected against that. We want to keep them functioning well, even in the course of experiencing high demand as they're going through the academic semester or pre-deployment training. Our prediction is that if they engage in some form of mental training, for example, mindfulness training, over this high demand period, they may stay stable in their performance over time, whereas individuals going through high demand who aren't participating in such training decline over time. And if we want to be very optimistic about this, we might predict that beyond simply staying stable over time, if you really commit to the exercises in these mindfulness training programs, you might be able to actually improve your performance from where you started, even if you're undergoing a high demand period of time. So let me bring you into the laboratory and give you a sense of how we're going to test attention. How do we see if attentional performance is better? How do we ask if mind wandering is less? And one way we do this is by giving people, like I said, very simple tasks. I'll give you a sense of one experiment that we did. This experiment was interested in seeing attentional performance, in particular sustained attentional performance, over a 20-minute period of time. We wanted to see if people could maintain their focus, and we also wanted to know if they mind wandered and got internally distracted away from the task. This is a little bit of a tricky thing to do, because of course if we asked them to mind wander, then they're not actually doing anything wrong. They're following our task instructions. So we had to design an experiment that promoted mind wandering without ever telling them to mind wander. So we designed an attention experiment that might be considered one of the world's most boring experiments. It's called the sustained attention response task. And what happens in this experiment is the participant is seated in a room in front of a computer screen, and they see a number on the screen. Every time they see a number, they're to press a button. And we're looking at the accuracy with which they're pressing and the speed with which they're pressing that button. Sounds simple enough. The only slightly interesting aspect of this experiment is that when that digit is 3, they are to withhold their responses. So you'd see a series of numbers, you press the button over and over again. Infrequently, 5% of the time, a 3 would appear and you'd have to withhold. Now, as you can imagine, this is kind of a boring experiment, and pretty soon people, though they can plainly see the numbers on the screen, will press the button to the 3. And when you ask them, what happened? Why did you press the button? Usually it'll be a response such as, oh, I wandered away from the task. My mind was not on the task anymore. I kind of was in autopilot just pressing the buttons. It's unfortunate, but it happens reliably. And it may be of no consequence in the context of this experiment, but you can imagine that a student missing content in lecture, or a soldier on patrol or a firefighter really standing watch, having their mind wander away can be quite problematic. So the study I'd like to tell you about, and many of the others that we've done kind of follow the same pattern, offered individuals a mindfulness training program. These were undergraduates that came in to our lab, participated in a 7-hour, 7-week mindfulness training course in which they learned these foundational mindfulness practices with us. And we were interested in seeing what their attention looked like on this sustained attention task at the beginning of that interval and again at the end of that interval. We randomly assigned individuals to either get mindfulness training or we had a control group that did not receive this training. Now, there's one important thing to keep in mind. When we recruited students into this study, we did it during 2 time intervals. Once was during the academic semester, when the stresses and strain of the semester are high, and another time was during summer break. Our prediction is that over summer break, students may have stable attention because they don't have the academic demands. But over the semester, their attention may decline because of the pressures and demands of the semester. Indeed, over summer break, attention is stable. There are no costs to your attention over a 7-week period of time if you're an undergraduate. But this is the unfortunate part. When we look at those same types of students over the semester and they're not offered mindfulness training, their attention significantly declined. So they were compromised in their ability to pay attention. And remember again that we tested them right before final season, and that's the point at which their attention was the lowest. So now let's ask the key question, which is what happened in individuals that weren't just involved in taking our experiments, but actually performed the mindfulness training intervention. The news there is quite promising. What we found is that unlike their counterparts who didn't get the training and declined in their attention, those who received mindfulness training were able to stay stable there in their attention and actually slightly improve in their attention over the 7-week period of time. So this is just one example in the education context, but the same pattern is seen over and over again. And now there are many studies from my research lab as well as many others in which there are reliable improvements found with mindfulness training in different aspects of cognitive functioning, selective attention improvements, working memory improvements, and reductions in mind wandering, which is quite promising from our point of view in thinking about mindfulness training as brain training. Just to remind you, what most people said were their motivations for training the brain had to do with either wanting to feel better, meaning they wanted to be more psychologically healthy, perform better, meaning they wanted their cognitive functioning to be improved, or to age better. They wanted to be better protected from age-related brain changes or brain diseases. And I want to say, broadly speaking, mindfulness training may be a successful strategy by which to train the brain. In our time together, I've mostly focused on the performance aspects and the brain aging aspects that have to do with better gyrification, for example. But I'd like to broaden out for just a second to give you a sense of what we know even about psychological health in mindfulness training. And as you recall, psychological health may be very much intertwined with our attentional capacity to protect us from depression or hypervigilance or even ADHD when our attention systems and working memory systems aren't performing at optimal levels. So one recent meta-analysis actually involved 47 studies, and I want to give you a sense of what they said with regard to the benefits of mindfulness training on psychological health. This was a study published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, one of the premier journals of the field of medicine. What they said is that the effects were small, modest, 10 to 20% improvements, but I really think it's interesting to think about how they translated how those effects work. They said the effects are comparable with what would be expected from the use of an antidepressant in a primary care population, but without associated toxicities. What does that mean? Essentially, allowing people to, in a daily fashion, engage in mindfulness training had effects comparable to a pharmacologic solution they may take to improve their psychological health. But in this sense, the improvement was in their own hands. The more they practiced, the more they benefited with regard to their psychological health. This is very exciting as a promising route by which we may think of mindfulness training as brain training, even for psychological health improvement. When it comes to that next feature of improving our performance or performing better as a motivation for brain training, as I recently reviewed with you, there are many examples now of improvements in cognitive functioning that happen with mindfulness training, working memory, selective attention, mind-wandering reductions. So the third pillar of why people say they'd like to engage in brain training has to do with better aging and better protection for their brains as we age. One thing to know about aging is that our brains do change over the course of our lifetime, and there is such a thing as normal, healthy aging. One feature of that is that brain density in specific regions of the brain actually is reduced. It's like the brain becomes less gyrified and almost thinner in its cortical density as we age. And that's normal. But what recent studies have found is that mindfulness practitioners actually seem better protected against that normal age-related decline. Their brains don't look like they're showing that trajectory of decline. It's as if mindfulness training is protecting against normal aging, which is also quite exciting. The research evidence with regard to physical health and physical well-being is expansive, 300,000 articles. And of course, we have to keep in mind that we're nowhere near that number with regard to mindfulness training. But yet, as we've reviewed, there's a lot of exciting, promising evidence that suggests that the brain can be structurally, functionally healthier when people engage in mindfulness training. And there may be routes by which mindfulness training can protect against performance declines, performance vulnerabilities under high stress, and even improve performance. So there is hope, and there's a lot more work yet to be done.
Coming up next, Dr. Alyssa Apple will show you how mindfulness training techniques can help you live younger, healthier, longer.
So we know what the levers are. We know a lot of what slows down aging, what speeds it up. And as you'll see, it has a lot to do with how well you know yourself.
Lecture 13, The Science of Mindful Aging.
Dr. Alyssa Apple is an author, professor, internationally recognized expert in mindfulness, stress, and aging. Over 10 years ago, she discovered that severe stress can impact the cellular aging process. And since then, she and her colleagues have been studying how mindfulness interventions can improve and slow the aging process. Alyssa is probably the smartest human being I know, and I'm delighted she's joining us on this journey.
Welcome. Thank you for joining me. It's my pleasure to talk to you today about mindful aging. And this is a fascinating topic because it involves most of what you've heard so far about mindfulness in different aspects of life. And I'm going to tell you about how our cells age, the things that slow down and speed up our aging, and how you can apply these to your own day and your own life. This takes some self-reflection on your part if you're going to really use some of what the science points us to. So aging is inevitable, but our rate of aging is actually elastic, and it's partly under our control. So while aging is a product of our genetics, it's also a product of our life experience, our lifestyle, and how we are experiencing each moment as it unfolds. So I'm going to talk about the biology of aging, how our cells actually age, what causes our cells to either die early or to stop dividing and replenishing tissue. So we know what the levers are. We know a lot of what slows down aging, what speeds it up. And as you'll see, it has a lot to do with how well you know yourself. So I'm going to ask you to just pause here and grab a pad of paper and a pen. And by the end of this, you're going to have some very strong guiding principles that you can use for the rest of your life. So that's a tall order. So let's get started. I would like you to just reflect on your own stage of life. Wherever you're at right now, what are your concerns? What is your view of the future? So it doesn't matter how old you are, but I'm going to talk to you as if you're 50 or older and that you've lived half your life and you may be starting to think more about aging and the experience of aging. We kind of ignore aging because it doesn't feel like anything until it starts happening. Then you start thinking about it when your body starts changing. So you have crossed some thresholds in life, important thresholds by now. You've chosen a career path. You've made a living. You may have chosen a life partner or raised children. And those are huge challenges that are behind you at midlife. And so now it's a really important time to reflect on your future and actually make conscious choices about how you want to spend the rest of your life. There are questions that we don't really typically ask ourselves about the future. So even just thinking about retirement, there's actually been studies showing that we spend more time planning a vacation, choosing a Netflix to see, choosing what to eat, than we spend planning our retirement, which is crazy, right? Because that's decades of our life, important years of our life that could be different or better. So think about these questions. How long do you want to live? When people ask me that, I can tell you that after studying aging, my answer is not to 100, as it might have been, but rather, I want to live as long as I am healthy, as long as I'm well and I can do things. And actually, that's a kind of copy that answer. The longest lived human being, Jean Clément, when she was about 120, she was asked, why do you want to keep living? What is it that you look forward to? And her answer was, I can still do stuff. She had this social network. She was riding her bike into town. She was fully living. My next question for you is, what do you look forward to when you think about your future? And how do you want to spend your time besides work? And even more important, who do you want to spend your time with? So in many studies of aging, such as the Harvard Longitudinal Study of Aging, when they look at longevity to see what are the common factors that lead people to live long, healthy lives, one of the factors is love. It's social network. It's being with other people. So at the end of life, if you think about what you'd want on your epitaph or on your tombstone, it's pretty a grim picture, but it really, even though we spend so much time thinking about our current goals, about making money, about work, it's never, I wish I spent more hours at the office. And it's usually about love and relationships. Now that you have some answers to those big questions, I want to tell you more about what's happening inside of our cells and how our cells are responding to the way we live, to how much love we have in our life, to how much purpose and meaning, and of course to our lifestyle. So what do we know about how our cells age? I'm going to tell you about four ways that our cells age that we're just discovering so much about, and it's just fascinating. So the first is inflammation. As we age, the inflammation in our blood rises a bit over time, over the years, but not for everyone. So there's variable rates of inflammation. And this inflammation in our blood, we call it systemic inflammation, causes aging of body tissue. It causes this kind of ripe, fertile ground for diseases like cancer. So we want to keep our inflammation low. We even call it inflam aging because it's so tied up with aging. So that's, I think of as a main pathway or highway to how our bodies age. So we want to think about what can we do? What do we do every day that reduces inflammation rather than increases it? Now there's another way that our cells age that I've been studying for over 15 years, and that is how quickly our telomeres shorten. Telomeres are the caps at the ends of our chromosomes. They're made of DNA, but they're not genes. They're these strings of repeating base pairs that actually protect the ends of our chromosomes. So our chromosomes contain our genes. Our genes are what make us unique. They make us who we are. They encode every single protein in our body in every cell. And it's very important that our genes are protected throughout life and not damaged, because when they get damaged by chemicals like free radicals, that's when we get problems. That's when we get bad cells, cancer cells, cells that die. So telomeres protect the cells, protect the genome, but they also shorten as we age. And then, of course, here's the catch. They don't shorten the same rate in everyone. Their rate of shortening is elastic. And so we can do things in our daily life that protect our telomeres and keep them longer and stable. Now, inflammation and telomeres are very close. When we have a lot of inflammation, it shortens our telomeres. When our telomeres are short, it creates the cell's environment to be pro-inflammatory. Now, there's a third player in the cell, and that is the mitochondria. So these are little energy-making machines. These are the little batteries in our cells. And we need these mitochondria to be fully powered throughout life because they give us energy. They make ATP. They keep us feeling vital. And so, of course, they wear out, as most things do, wear out with aging at a variable rate. And when they get a little bit worn, they start leaking free radicals, and that creates oxidative stress. And these free radicals can damage the telomeres, which are right near the mitochondria. They all kind of live together in the cell. That's a problem. So we want telomeres and mitochondria to be supporting each other. But what happens if the telomeres get too short, they send signals to the mitochondria wear out, and vice versa. When the mitochondria start wearing out and spewing these free radicals, it shortens the telomeres. So it's all kind of one family system in there. And then the last thing I'm going to tell you is that we are learning so much about how our DNA is turned on and off. So we can't change our genes. We're born with one set of genes at birth for our whole life. But they do turn on and off based on signals. Some of the signals are ones that we tell our genes, like if we're under chronic stress and feel danger, we're going to have our genes express a different pattern. It's going to be more pro-inflammatory. Now, there's a way that we turn genes on and off that is a little bit more long-term and permanent, and that is through methylation bonds. So the epigenome, the proteins around or above the genome, can turn genes on and off. And we now know that we can measure the pattern of our epigenetics. It matches our age roughly, but some of us are a bit older, some of us are a bit younger than our chronological age. So this is a new way we can look into our cells and determine our age. It's roughly correlated with telomeres in a small way, so they're kind of different pathways of aging. Now, one thing all of these pathways have in common is that if we're under chronic stress or traumatic stress, if we've experienced a lot of trauma, we tend to have aged our cells more in these four ways. So what I'm going to talk to you about today is how we can slow our cell aging, and stress is a big part of that. Stress and aging are really closely related because our aging biology listens to signals from stress, all the chemical signals from stress. Now, you've heard a lot about mindfulness in this great course, and you might be wondering, what about meditation? So when I first published a paper on telomeres around 15 years ago, and we showed that caregiving parents, people who are under chronic stress, tended to have shorter telomeres, the question that emerged immediately, both from people as well as in my mind, was, well, can you slow this telomere shortening process with meditation or mind-body interventions? So now, over a decade later, I can tell you that there have been many studies. Some are big controlled randomized trials. Most are smaller studies, but they tend to show that if you take up a mind-body activity, not just mindfulness, but it could be Qigong or different types of meditation, and you commit to that for several months, these studies mostly tend to show we can reduce our inflammation, our levels of CRP, C-reactive protein, and we can stabilize our telomeres. And so the rate of shortening is slower if we're doing a regular mind-body practice like that than the rate of telomere shortening in people who are not. And I could just end there, right? So the message is, take up a mind-body practice and be committed to it. But I'm not going to end there, because that's just one piece. It's a way to learn about your mind, your mind-body, and be intimate with understanding yourself and how you affect other people in the world and how you are affected. So it's a really wonderful, critical tool. But what I'm going to talk to you about is how mindfulness and awareness, attitudes, tendencies, personality styles we have, how these are shaping the rate of our cell aging. We all carry around these stereotypes of people, and we're not really aware of them, but actually most of us have developed a pretty negative stereotype of aging while we're young, when we don't worry about aging. So just take a minute and write down the negative thoughts that you have when you think about aging and any positive associations you have with aging. So what are your stereotypes? When you think of aging, what does it remind you of? You might think of pain, suffering, fear of dependency, fear of dementia, fear of leaving people behind. So let's face it, we have pretty negative views of aging. But actually, if you look closely at the research, many of these are myths. And while some of aging and the physical part is inevitable, there are benefits and there's a richness and a growth that comes with aging that is been shown in study after study. So some of the things are wisdom, more positive emotions, a better balance in your daily life between negative and positive emotions, having a more positive social network. So when we're young, we might think that we want a big, sprawling social network and lots of connections, and those relationships actually tend to be more superficial and have more negative aspects. People who don't necessarily make us feel supported, or they actually make us feel insecure or criticized. But older people in general tend to prune their social network to have a more positive emotional tone, people who they feel good around. So there's a lot of positive psychological states and wisdom that comes with aging. So I want you to think of someone who is a role model in aging for you. Could be someone famous, could be someone you know, and write down that name. Because it turns out that if you keep these negative views of aging, which we all have unconsciously, if we just let them fester, the more negative our views of aging, the more likely we're going to have early aging, memory loss, hearing loss, slower healing when we have a hip fracture, more likely to have dementia, and earlier mortality. That's a big list. That's a pretty bad list. So a pioneer in this area about aging stereotypes is a colleague of mine. Her name is Becca Levy at Yale, and she has done some amazing studies. Some have been countrywide, showing, for example, countries who believe as a culture that people, when they age, have much lower status in society and view aging as very negative, have a much higher rate of dementia. So that's at the country level. But then in an individual level, in big survey studies, like the Health and Retirement Study, individuals who hold more negative views of aging are more likely to get Alzheimer's dementia. So that's enough in my book for us to take this quite seriously. There have been lots of studies trying to ask what kind of personality is most resistant to aging. And if there was a mindful personality, it would probably be conscientiousness. Conscientious personalities are one of the strongest personality predictors of longevity, of healthy longevity. So what does conscientious mean? Governed by conscience, it's the literal definition. So it's when we are aware of our impact on other people and we're mindful of other people and we try to be very conscientious, responsible, careful, reliable, meticulous. So there's a lot of traits that go along with conscientiousness. The conscientious people tend to plan ahead more and be less impulsive. So there's been a tremendous amount of research on conscientiousness and longevity, particularly by Howard Friedman. He followed a large sample of young men, the Terman study, and found that when you measure personality young in life, it's not the cheery kids who live longer like you'd think. It's those who are much more mindful and conscientious. So what are the health behaviors that slow aging? Well, there's an easy way to think about what is going to slow aging. That is to think about what is most anti-inflammatory and antioxidative stress. What's going to soak up free radicals and reduce inflammation? So if we think about diet, for example, it is whole foods and fiber that create an anti-inflammatory diet. And conversely, it's the refined sugars and the meat that create more of this kind of pro-inflammatory diet. And as we would expect, these are the two diet patterns that are related to telomere length. So having more vegetables is related to longer telomeres. Having more meat and soda is related to shorter telomeres. Same with inflammation. So when we think about what we eat, it's good to think in terms of just rather than superfoods and what's going to be, you know, the most antioxidant thing I can eat is really just processed foods are going to be completely pro-aging, whereas whole foods are you it's hard to eat too many vegetables, for example. And having unprocessed meat is much better than processed meat, particularly for cell aging and for telomeres. So I actually wrote a book a couple years ago on all of the different levers that slow down and speed up telomere aging. And I did this with my colleague, Elizabeth Blackburn, who is a molecular biologist who discovered the telomere-telomerase system. She discovered how these cells age by having telomere shorten too much and by having this enzyme called telomerase be slowing and repairing telomeres. And so this book's called The Telomere Effect, and it focuses a lot on these lifestyle factors. I'm not going to go too into them, except for to say that we did learn some good news as we were discovering what, out of all the hundreds of studies, is related to long telomere length or stable telomere length. And it's not necessarily running marathons and doing extreme sports and activity, but rather moderate activity is enough. You don't get much longer telomeres than you do if you're just running a moderate amount a week than if you're running ultramarathons. Now, for the rest of our time together, I'm going to focus on, rather than on the health behaviors, which you already know what you should be doing, and what's good for the heart and what's good for the brain is also good for cell aging. So there are not too many surprises there. But I want to talk about a few invisible factors that we don't typically think of as important to our aging. And one is stress resilience. Another is love and support, and finding meaning and purpose. So we talked about toxic stress, how very severe or traumatic stress or stress that goes on for years and years, like job strain or caregiving, how those can lead to speedier cell aging. The answer, you would think, is avoid stress. Maybe I shouldn't go back to work. Maybe I shouldn't go out and do this, you know, activity that has all these social risks or physical risks. And that natural tendency to kind of avoid stress in life is actually the opposite of what we should be doing, which is we should be pursuing moderate doses of stressful things. That is actually what makes our body more resilient to aging and makes us actually more resilient psychologically too. So one key point here is that the biology of stress and the biology of aging are intricately intertwined. So on one hand, extreme stress and too big of a dose speeds up aging. But on the other hand, small doses of stress actually slow aging. So let me give you a dramatic example from the animal world. So this has been discovered over and over in cells and in lower species, in worms, in rodents. And for example, if you take worms and you heat them up, you fry them up in a pan just a little bit, they actually live longer. You're turning on anti-aging mechanisms called hormesis. If you keep frying them, turn up the heat too high, of course they die. So this hormesis is this kind of fine balance of like a moderate dose of stress that the organism can deal with. What is that to you? What is that in your life that promotes positive stress? Positive stressors help you grow and are anti-aging. So you want to think about some things that will put you on the edge, a little bit out of your comfort zone. Now, this is really important, particularly for us as we age, because we need new challenges, and that keeps our cognitive function sharp as well. Now, I'm going to give you an example of a positive stressor. There is a beautiful natural experiment called the Experience Core. The Experience Core is an experiment where this group of researchers and socially oriented activists decided to really see how can we help both elderly people age well and also help all of these at-risk school children, underprivileged children who aren't getting their social needs or their tutoring needs met. So they matched up retired people. They came to their doors and their homes and they asked them, are you interested in trying to be a tutor in this local school and being matched up with a child? Now, how would you feel about that? You have not been working for years. You're comfortable and safe at home. Now you're being asked to go into a school and do something you've never done. And it might even be a bit of a low-income or dangerous environment. The beauty of the Experience Corps is that not only did the kids benefit, but the elderly people who said yes and who volunteered and took on this new role in life, their health got better too. Their mental function got better. Their hippocampus, the part of their brain that controls memory in the men who did this, actually grew in volume. And so it's this example where it was stressful for them and they had to deal with a lot of issues that were happening in the child's life. Things like not having enough food, or not having their basic needs met. And so it wasn't an easy job, but they grew from it psychologically and they grew in what we call generativity. They felt more purpose and meaning in their life as an Experience Corps volunteer. So this is an example in my mind of both doing something that makes your life more meaningful and also is a positive stressor. So this idea of positive stress just hasn't been explored enough in humans, but I believe that there are some very safe forms of this to suggest to you. Now, what do you do in your own life that's positive stress? There's not that many things that we do that get us really stressed out that we think are good for us. But one is exercise. That's a physiological stressor. Getting a moderate amount of exercise is, of course, anti-aging. And we know that in many different ways. Having it in terms of a little burst, the high-intensity interval training, is something that's just starting to be more studied. But it looks like that is just as good as the longer endurance, slower sport. And that makes a lot of sense physiologically, that when we stress out our bodies, we actually are causing more of these anti-aging mechanisms, scavengers to soak up free radicals, for example. And that is because when the stressor is over, we turn on all of these mechanisms that cause us to clean up cells. So autophagy, the little Pac-Man cleanup machines in our cells, are much higher and more active after we've exercised, for example. And then in terms of our nervous system, once we have had a lot of sympathetic activity, then the sympathetic system turns on the parasympathetic system. We call this the vagus nerve. And that turns on very strongly after we've had a bout of stress. And that is a really important way to think about our nervous system. We want to have vagal tone. We want to relax when we can relax. We want to be really have a good, strong peak stress response when we're dealing with a stressor. And then we want to have a quick recovery. So think of it like this. When you're safe, notice that you're safe. Tell yourself, right now, I can fully relax. There's nothing that is wrong in this moment. And let that be true if it's true. The reason why it's often not true is because our thoughts, because we're keeping threat alive in our mind. We're ruminating and we're worrying about things. We're either ruminating about wishing things were different or we're worrying about the future. So if we can be present and let our bodies respond to that, those feelings of safety, that is what we think of as a restorative state. Let yourself be in restorative state when you are safe. You are safe more than your mind thinks it is. When we want to face a challenge, you want to have a big stress response. Stress is good for us, and then we want to have a big recovery. Now, part of that big recovery means that we stop ruminating and thinking over negative aspects. I wish I did better, et cetera, things like that. So catching those thoughts is really critical. And what skill does that take? You've been hearing about different forms of mindfulness, but it's only if we can actually become aware and look at our thoughts that we can catch that type of vigilance that we carry with us, those negative thoughts that keep us vigilant. So I've been so interested in positive stress, I'm getting to do a very interesting study right now in my lab where we're just comparing different types of positive stress. So we're comparing an extreme form of breathing might have heard of Wim Hof breathing. So we're comparing the practice of just doing hyperventilation and hypoxia and exposure to cold. So you know how relaxed you might feel after you do hot and cold baths. So that's an example of how we condition the nervous system. So we're looking at these short-term physical stressors, high-intensity exercise. So these are two